Last week we pointed out that in some matters the modern concepts of anthropology come into conflict with metaphysical teachings covering approximately the same area of human thought and interest. This conflict continues into our present session, and in order to clarify it as much as we can, we must try to cover the several related fields which influence the major theme. Today, anthropology stands in a kind of middle distance between two other forms of learning. On one side is ethnology, which is more or less ethnic biology. It has to do with the exact problems of man's biological ascent in nature and culminates in the rise of social conditions. On the opposite side of anthropology is psychology, which is concerned profoundly with many of the elements which are now regarded as peculiarly the property of the anthropological group. Thus, between biology and psychology, anthropology takes a middle position, deriving certain of its data from each of these opposing or contrasting groups. And tonight, as our subject deals with the nature of soul and the problem of the ensouling of man, we come to another interesting situation. We have heard many definitions of souls, theological and philosophical. We also recognize the scientific approach to the psychic equation in human life. But now we must consider for a moment a phase of the subject which perhaps has not generally come to our attention, namely the soul in terms of anthropology. It is quite different in many distinct details from other concepts. Aristotle anciently opined that the soul was in some way directly associated with motion, that in a sense things move because of the psychic life within them. Now, this motion principle, however, Aristotle refined in many ways. But at the same time, although he distinguished various types of motion, he still held to the conviction that it is the soul that moves things, and that this motion is of itself of two kinds: movement in terms of body and movement which is not in terms of body. Movement in terms of body we behold around us constantly. Movement in terms which are not of body we also intellectually behold, until it becomes almost as familiar to us as the movement of body. Yet this movement which is not of body requires a different approach in an effort to understand its meaning and its part in our way of life. This non-body motion may be likened to a qualitative motion, as distinguished from a quantitative or physically directive motion. A man walking from Los Angeles to San Diego accomplishes the crossing of a quantitative interval, which we describe in terms of miles. He does this by means of a motion arising within himself by which he is able to take this long and tiresome walk. another man moving from the state of ignorance to the state of knowledge also crosses an interval. An interval perhaps more difficult to cross than the miles between Los Angeles and San Diego. Yet by the method used to measure the travel of the walking man, we are unable to approach or conceive the interval crossed by the thinking man. Thus we have a motion which does not move things visibly or physically, but does make possible the bridging of intervals and distances of a qualitative nature. Thus we must have a quantitative and a qualitative motion. In ancient times, qualitative motion was perhaps more interesting to man than it is today. Seeking to understand the movement of the psyche in himself, the movement of his own soul life, man began to identify motion of the soul with anthropological or cultural motion. Thus, in one definition, anthropology is the science of the cultural motion in man, or the soul motion in man. It does not deal primarily with clinical problems. It deals with the grand motion of culture. If a man writes a book, and I read one not long ago, and he was a learned man, and he wrote a book entitled The Soul of Greece. Now this book had absolutely nothing to do with religion, metaphysics, or psychology, as we commonly think of these terms. It had to do, essentially, with anthropological motion. In searching for the soul of Greece, this particular author gave us an outline of its philosophies, its religions, its arts, its sciences, its beliefs and opinions on a variety of subjects. And though he covered the fields of religion and philosophy, he did not do this as a metaphysician or as a mystic. He merely recognized religion and philosophy as aspects of culture, as the results or part of the results arising from the ascending human contact with the refinements of mature living, the association of the person and the group with an overall psychic conviction, pattern, or way. The anthropological aspect of this, then, tells us that cultures are not usually totally indigenous. Culture represents a stream moving anthropologically through humanity, or moving humanity along a road or path. All culture groups derive certain knowledge or conviction from preceding groups and bestow a certain fruitfulness upon all succeeding groups. Thus, culture may rest for a time with a people, but culture moves from nation to nation, from race to race, from generation to generation, enriched in its motion by the contributions of countless peoples, many of whom no longer exist as independent cultural groups. This motion, then, of a cultural stream through time, a stream invisible as far as our physical senses are concerned, but constantly impelling to the performance of actions which are visible, or consequences which can be seen. This motion is the anthropological psyche. It is the movement of man's attainment. It is the continual enrichment of this movement. It is the eternal and endless progression of things. in terms of the unfolding of their attributes and the enrichment of the institutions which they create as they move down through history. The soul then, to these peoples, to this anthropological group, is the consummation or the summary of culture at any given time and under any given group of circumstances. It can be examined historically. It can be contemplated philosophically. It can be approached religiously. But these represent interpretations of something which has a nature in itself. This thing that has a nature in itself, an accumulating, unfolding, growing entity of its own, is the cultural soul of man. Thinking in these terms and upon this foundation, then, we come upon immediately certain other factors which have to be taken into consideration. We can either follow the materialistic point of view, merely that culture is therefore the continuous heaping up or aggregation of common attainment, that each generation, through its own natural experience with phenomena, enriches the total cultural life of the world. And that the outstanding individual who attains in any particular, so that he leaves an impress upon his time, or upon his people, or upon future ages, becomes a powerful cultural unit. And up to the present time, a small group of perhaps 15 or 20,000 persons recorded out of the total body of history represent the spearhead of man's cultural progress. Culture is therefore not only vested in the accumulation of total groups, it is led or moved dynamically by individuals who respond in an exaggerated or larger way to the reactions which to the ordinary person are met with less intensity or less directive. If in this thinking we come to a point of deviation between anthropology and metaphysics, perhaps this division again is not as real as at first appears. For a long time, we have been plagued with an attitude, namely that if a certain effect is visible to us, a certain condition arises in our phenomenal world, we assume that the cause of that condition must always be according to the dominant way of thinking which most influences our times. It does not occur to us that comparatively similar effects can arise from widely different causes. This point we have to give some special attention to. We know that we are not always correct when we use the sensory perceptions as a means of establishing fact. We know that for a great period of time, human beings actually believed that the sun set in the west because it appeared to do so. They assumed that the diurnal motion was the motion of the sun. They did not realize that it was actually the rotation of the earth itself. Thus, explanations were built which satisfied things which men could see, but these explanations were not true. It follows by this that an explanation which is plausible and even probable and may be strongly supported and sustained by physical evidence may at the same time not be true. From this we must proceed then to the fact that we observe culture. We know that man is moving. We know that he is unfolding an individual and collective psychic entity. We are not, however, at this time, in a good position to analyze the actual cause of this cultural motion. We are not sure that it is merely the result of constant impact of external stimuli, nor are we sure that the possibility of culture is sustained by hereditary descent or by certain fortunate biological factors in the life of an individual or a collective group. Thus, the physical circumstances upon which both psychology and anthropology function may exist with explanations other than those now broadly and generally accepted. We have reason to understand this, perhaps, merely by a program of research into past thought. And we will find in so doing that persons of admirable abilities and extraordinary intellect came to conclusions long ago which we no longer accept as valid. We have advanced others, but there is no reason to doubt that in time to come, others following us will find still more adequate explanations, which may or may not sustain those that we now regard as sufficient. Therefore, in the study of our psychic problem, we have no absolute certainty that the human soul is identical with culture. We have no actual certainty that the human soul is identical with mind. We find such identities convenient. They seem to answer questions not easily answered without such concepts. But every concept, though it may increase the reasonableness of our conclusions, every concept fails in some particular. We have never yet developed a concept which is totally and completely sufficient. Today, perhaps our concepts include more than was once known. But on the other hand, to strengthen and develop our concepts, we have been forced to reject a great deal of evidence that was once held to be valid. In order to make our own way of life scientifically acceptable, for example, we have had to deny almost categorically the miraculous, the mystical, and numerous occasions and instances strongly sustained by history and not easily assailable. We have had to ignore them and deny them simply because they will not fit into our prevailing attitudes. So every time we have a new attitude, we gain something and we lose something. And in the course of time, the trend in modern thinking has been for man to gain greater objectivity, but to lose more and more of his subjectivity. To lose in the progress of growth a great many concepts and ideas which were essentially beautiful, noble, and calculated to improve him culturally. Thus, in our way of life today, we have advanced certain specializations, but most persons of thoughtful mind will agree that our cultural situation is not secure, that we have sacrificed too much of the nobility of man in the quest of exactitudes. And in the sacrificing of this nobility, we have weakened man as a being. And we have thrown culture into opposition with science, advancing science at the expense of culture, advancing certain phases of ourselves at the cost of the total self. It is quite possible, therefore, that the anthropological soul, the cultural soul of man, is itself sustainable as a concept, but not as a total one. That it is an aspect of something greater than itself. And it is also quite probable that nearly every concept that we have is depending upon concepts which we do not have. And that for a total and sufficient way of life, we must have more knowledge of causes than we presently possess, and must therefore be able to generate larger concepts, more holistic, more total, than those which we have and know today. If, in the study of the descent of man, we want to pause for a moment then and bring up to date that which was the ancient and previous thinking of man, in order that we may view this thinking in terms of our present situation. And we will begin with a little bit with the philosophical background of the doctrine or idea which is now embodied in anthropology. Ancient man, rationalizing, contemplating upon the mystery of himself and of the world in which he found himself, early came to the conclusion that all outward things are moved by inward forces. Also, that all inferior bodies in nature are moved by superior forces, or by powers greater than themselves. We have this in the Socratic and Platonic concepts of motion, where we have orders of things, the unmoved, the self-moving, and the moved. We know that some things are moved. We know that the breaking up of a winter in the north brings down great masses of ice and carries with the flooding torrents, trees, and even houses, great rocks and boulders. We know, therefore, that while these things do not move of themselves, they are moved. Therefore, that motion can be imparted to things from without, as is the case of a person tossing a ball. The motion of the ball is not inherent in the ball. It is inherent in the person tossing the ball. On the other hand, there are things in which motion is inherent, things which are of themselves self-moving. And of those things which are self-moving, the world of the animal kingdom around us, including ourselves, may be regarded as the outstanding example. Man is a self-moving creature. Truly, he can be moved by circumstance. He can be physically moved by conditions around him. He may ride on a train, which carries him not by his own motion, but by a mechanical motion. But he may also be moved to action of his own, and mostly to decision, to attitude. And the motion of the individual from within himself, philosophically speaking, is the source of culture. It is the motion of the person, a movement from within, imparted to other things. Therefore, culture is not the painting, but the power to paint. It is not the building, but the power to build. All things in themselves, which are physically achieved by culture, bear witness to it, but they are not culture. They are monuments to culture. But culture itself is a living motion in man, present because man is self-moving, that he is capable of both quantitative and qualitative motion within his own nature. In this he is unique among the species which we know, in that he has carried qualitative motion further than any other form of life that is visible to us. Being a self-moving creature, man must therefore be moved by that which conveys motion or contributes motion. And the Greeks, the Orientals, many ancient peoples assume, therefore, that man's qualitative motion is due to his own soul, to a life motion in himself, to the existence within his nature of a psychic entity. That this psychic entity is the cause of all things about man, which cause him to move gradually from a biological to an anthropological foundation, finally perhaps to a psychological footing. This psychic life within man manifests early in the human experience and produces a variety of interesting, if somewhat confusing, results. Philosophically, man is recognized as a thinking animal. He is also recognized as a creature possessing within himself the power to imagine, the power to visualize. In the process of imagination, therefore, we find man polarized between two qualities of his own psychic nature. One is imagination, and the other is memory. By memory, man is bound to the past. By imagination, man can anticipate the future. Imagination is therefore an overtone, a motion toward the unknown. Now, imagination can lead to fantasy. It can also lead to hallucination. It can result in the individual surrounding himself with unreal and unreasonable fears. It can terrify the individual and tyrannize upon all of his other faculties. But in its natural and proper state, particularly under a cultural background, imagination becomes man's escape forward. It makes possible the dream of future. The dream of future makes orderly progress natural and reasonable for man. Now pause for a moment again and turn to the religious consideration. As we go back anthropologically into the history of man, we perceive that the religious equation arises very early in his human experience. One of the earliest observations of man had to do with the difference between that which could be explained and that which could not be explained. Not in this case empiric necessarily, but in terms of his own experience. That which any man cannot explain occupies a different relationship to him than that which he can explain. That which can be explained is normal. That which cannot be explained is hypernormal, or supernormal, or supernatural. Consequently, man's relationship with life has always been divided into two parts: his relationship with the known and his relationship with the unknown. Now, there are tribes in various parts of the world who have tried to solve the problem of such relationships. One of them was the Yazids of Iraq, a group of people whom we call the Yazidi. They still exist as a small religious sect, sometimes called devil worshippers. These devil worshippers are very intriguing because of the basic logic which dominates their thinking. These people are not really devil worshippers. They believe in a good God, but they do not feel or sense the need to worship this good God. Why offer or pray or in one way or another attempt to please a good God? If this God is good, he is not going to hurt you anyway. On the other hand, there are the unknown negative forces of nature, personified in the concept of evil. These people, therefore, find it in their thinking more utilitarian to try to keep evil spirits happy than to worry about good spirits. It is of no concern to them whether they worship God or not, because God understands everything, knows everything, and is eternally good. But the evil spirits, likely to bring plagues and pestilence, and to destroy the harvest, and to make women barren, and to cripple children, or to strike down the mature in their fullness of age, these kind of beings we must always cater to. So it is to the evil spirits that the foods and offerings are made and that the prayers are raised, asking these spirits not to hurt them. There is no use asking God not to hurt them, because he will not. Now this is a simple example of what more or less divided man at a very early period. This problem of the known with which he could cope and the unknown with which he could not cope. And around the unknown, which was mystery, he developed a series of positive attitudes, positive concepts about the negative. These positive concepts about negation resulted in the primitive social religious structure of savage peoples. It consisted of man's attempting to anticipate with his own consciousness the invisible factors of life around him. He was unable to do this rationally. He had to do it emotionally. He was unable to prove one step of his journey, yet he believed definitely in the journey because of other things which he could prove and which became obvious to him. When one child grew up and the other child died, there could only be one answer, namely a supernatural factor. As far as he could tell, there was no natural solution. Therefore, he began to think in terms of the evil eye, of witchcraft, and of innumerable machinations by means of which the life of the child could be destroyed by sorcery or something of that nature. There was no other explanation. In many cases, of course, we know that this sorcery was merely an ancient name for lack of hygiene. But ancient man did not know that. So while he knew nothing of hygiene or eugenics, these subjects were magic. He was unable to systematize any way of coping with the implications in fields where he had no knowledge. Therefore, he created an elaborate network of intangibles by means of which he satisfied, to a measure, his own concepts. Now, why was he in need of satisfying his concepts? Because, as anthropology points out, from the beginning, man had certain cultural instincts. These cultural instincts were very strong in ancient times. And one of these cultural instincts was that things could not happen without reason. There has to be an explanation. And as the God concept developed, this explanation could not and must not conflict with the belief in a good God. Therefore, God could not be finally held responsible for ungodly situations. And it was needed that other things should be introduced to form bridges or links or to provide explanations for things otherwise not to be explained. Out of all of this together, there rose a primitive religious psychic life. And from this came another very important psychological factor, namely, that man began to be moved by imponderables. He was no longer simply moved by the weather. He was no longer moved totally by the migration of animals, which he had to follow in order to secure food. He was no longer moved by storms or by any of these things primarily. He began to find other causes for major trends or major motions in his own affairs, And these causes were his beliefs, his attitudes, his convictions, and the rising structure of consequential conclusions. Thus man began to be inwardly moved by psychic pressure. Now we may wonder, and we do have to ask, whether this psychic pressure was totally the result of man living in a material mystery for which he had to find supernatural solutions, or whether these supernatural solutions to which he turned were available to him and he was impelled toward them only because of a psychic necessity within his own nature. In other words, is man to be decided as having been moved only by heredity and experience, or was he also moved by the fact that there was in him something by which he was human, and that this humanity gave him a different perspective, made possible the engendering of the element of mystery in his own consciousness, and that man gradually evolved mystery because he had a unique capacity for mystery, a capacity not so obvious in the other kingdoms of nature. Your religionist will assume that this was true, and that at a certain time in the remote development of man, something was contributed to him by which he was unique, and that this uniqueness rested in his humanity, for it is in his humanity alone that he is unique. We remember the story of the two Greeks that met out in front of the amphitheater, and one said he was going to the games and would be happy to take his friend. His friend, who was a philosopher of parts, declined. And the man who was going to the game said, "You are missing a wonderful opportunity. For this afternoon you will see men that can run faster than deers. You will see athletes who are stronger than bears. You will see swimmers that can swim better than fish." The philosopher nodded, "Yes, that's all probably true, but I'm not interested. But I will go with you when you can show to me a man, not who excels other animals, but who thinks, acts, feels, lives like a god, like his own uniqueness, not deriving his superiority from excelling in animal propensities, but by the excellence of his own humanity." This thought would also correspond with one strong opinion on the problem of man's soul nature. Anthropologists, ethnologists, zoologists, and many other branches of scientific thinkers have a number of little problems that they are not too able to explain. The animal kingdom, for example, is not merely one kingdom. Certainly, we can divide it without destroying the overtone of the collective animal type. But we know that there is some reason why a deer is not a dog. There is also a reason why a cat will always be a cat, and that this creature will have certain qualities and attributes which cannot be reconciled with or made similar to the attributes of a squirrel. Thus there are differences. Differences which cannot be totally explained by environment. Differences which seem to indicate that within the animal structure itself there are differentiations. That these differentiations will emerge and will reveal infinite specialization. Nature supporting this, in many instances, does not permit, in its natural procedure, the interbreeding of unrelated types. And usually where such interbreeding may accidentally occur, the progeny is sterile. Nature does not wish these types to be at least immediately reconciled. We must then come to the conclusion that there are differences in the archetypes or basic patterns of specialized forms of life. That these differences, while they exist markedly in animals, are not due to the psychological pressures which might cause differences in human beings. They are not due to religion, philosophy, and other cultural environments. They are due to something innate in the creature itself. These differences can be understood, but they cannot be totally overcome. Man differs from the other members of the animal kingdom in one other particular, namely, that whereas these other animals are divided into groups or into types or kinds, man very largely is an individual species in himself. Each human being is different in many respects from other human beings. He does not have the general instincts which mark a species or type of animals. If we have seen a cow, studied a cow, analyzed a cow, and perhaps psychoanalyzed that cow as far as we can, we have then a fair concept of cow. And we may meet 10,000 cows without any marked variation. But you can never analyze any human being so adequately that you know how any other human being thinks. You have a much greater individualization here. So that the human being becomes a distinct order of life in himself. Truly, this distinction develops gradually. Yet, as our anthropologist knows, you can go to a small island somewhere in what we might term an underprivileged area. And we will find 20 tribes on that island in comparatively close proximity to each other. And as far as we can discover, they have lived together there for an indefinite period of time, perhaps 1,000 years, perhaps 2,000 years, perhaps for an unknown period of time. Yet that little group of tribes has never become one entity. 15 tribes, maybe with not more than 500 members in each tribe and not more than 10 miles apart. 15 tribes, 15 languages. Perhaps en route similar, but not actually able to understand each other. 15 religions. Entirely different groups of attitudes. There are cases where in a group like that, one group will be cannibal, but not the others. There is another type of situation that is also noticeable there. One group may be agricultural, and another will still depend upon fishing and hunting for survival. One of these little groups may have created a comparatively well-organized cultural government. The next group, 20 miles away, is in anarchy and always has been. Out in the hinterland where you come upon these things, you can become continuously aware that neither proximity nor similarity of environment will result in identity in human type. There can only be one answer, that the division is deeper. The anthropologist insists that cultural division is enough. This is doubtful, and a number of progressive thinkers in the field are beginning to recognize that we've got to go deeper. In going deeper, therefore, we are searching now, anthropologically speaking, for the psychological factors in differentiation, and they are certainly present. And we cannot ignore them. Now, if we go into our mystical religions, into our so-called esoteric systems. Only a term which should not be considered so frightening as many so-called educated people have come to believe, for it simply means, in this sense, beliefs or traditions that have long been held either in secret or have become so broadly neglected that they have continued only in the custodianship of a few persons. Many so-called esoteric ideas were once common knowledge, even as many of our modern ideas were once esoteric. We cannot fail to observe that that motion goes both ways. Among the peoples of ancient times, who anthropologically are important to us, because we observe in them primary pressures, and the student of primitive psychology is deeply concerned with these elements also. In these primitive peoples, we have, from the beginning, the strong concept that man is primarily a psychic entity, that man differs from other known creatures because he is ensouled, because a living, thinking, feeling being is in the core and central part of his own nature. He therefore divides himself from the animal not because of the difference of body, but because he firmly believes that he is not his body, but that he is truly a person living in a body. Up to very recently, science has taken the attitude that there is no separate person occupying the human body, that the personality arises within the body and its experiences and its reflexes. But ancient man was convinced that he had a psychic entity. And even among such peoples as those we mentioned, the 15 little tribes on the island, the belief in this psychic entity is perhaps one of the few things that they shared in common. They had different interpretations of it, but all these little groups had some concept, even as aboriginal savages, they had some concept of a being in their own bodies. That they were not merely animated forms, but that this being in the body was more important than the body. Most ancient peoples also held that in some way this being is in an association with the body, but is not subject totally to the changes and modifications which occur in the body. One medieval thinker expressed it in a very interesting way. If soul is a byproduct of body, why is not the psychic life of man changed if he loses both legs? He is then no longer the same organization that he was before. Something is gone. Yet the loss of his arms, the loss of his legs, even the infirmities of his sensory perceptions do not essentially change his being. And usually, except in cases of certain types of disease which destroy function or structure, the actual entity of the individual does not greatly alter until the time of the general dissolution of the body. Also, most persons have recognized or realized that while the body passes through a series of conditions, that these conditions associated with the infirmities of age, or what we would term chronological aging, that these conditions are not contributed to the psychic being or entity. Once the individual recovers from the peculiar negative psychology of childhood and attains a more or less complete administration of his own nature from that time on, say from his teens to the end of his life. The being is not aware of aging. It becomes conscious of aging only through the infirmities of its body, but it is never itself able to determine as an inward, noumenal experience whether it is 20 or 40. It must look in the mirror. It must depend upon some external factor. And about the only difference that we note is body difference, resulting in loss of function, loss of vitality, or the exhaustion of bodily resources. The individual has these infirmities, but the knower in the body is essentially timeless. Primitive man found this out. It forced him, therefore, to the inevitable conclusion that when he was 70, he did not feel inside any different from the way he felt at 20. And if there was an essential difference in his condition, this difference was due to psychological factors. His friends told him he was old. People began getting chairs for him. Folks ran forward and helped him upstairs. These are the ways he discovered that he was old. Gradually he came to believe it. Also, as among the Chinese, who differ from us in so many details, age having a peculiar advantage. We have young Chinese people sitting around waiting, hopefully, to grow old. They want to grow old, because until they get to be 60 or 70, they are not really leaders in their way of life. China used to, and probably to some measure still does, reward years with the benefits that we reserve for youth. That is influence, power, security, happiness, opportunity of all kinds. When Sun Yat-sen became president of China, he convened a Congress and told the various districts to send their senators and representatives. It was a simple matter. Every district selected the oldest living inhabitant. The result is half the representatives died before they got to the Congress. But it was the way things were done. In many cases, some cases, the records tell us that these representatives were brought in carriages and in carts because they could no longer walk. But they were the leaders. They were the great people. So a difference in psychology arises here. The primitive man, from the beginning, sensed that there was a difference between his being and his body. From this came his inevitable conclusion that his relationship with the body was impermanent, was transitory. Another factor psychologically considered that came in here at an early date was that no human being, then or now, can experience the extinction of himself. No human being can actually experience the existence or state of not being. We may know that 100 years ago he wasn't here, but he cannot experience anything about his own state of not being here. He may affirm that 100 years from now, most certainly he will not be here, but he cannot imagine the state of not being here. He can write his will, he can make all arrangements for his family and relatives, and he can be perfectly factual about the transition that is inevitable, but he cannot experience it. Therefore, no living person has ever experienced death. And no living person has ever experienced a state of non-existence. Primitive man, forthright in these matters, being absolutely unable to experience the non-existence of himself, although he watched his friends come and go, and even today in civilization as we know it, we are not so much wiser, because some of the most brilliant attorneys in the world die without making a will. nobody expects or provides, except perhaps through cautiousness and responsibility, but never through the sense of the fact that he is going to cease to exist, because he cannot experience it. He can only rationalize it. It's a very different thing. So ancient man came to the conclusion that he was not only alive, but that he was life. That he existed because he participated in something that had an eternal existence. That life was eternal, that body appeared and disappeared. He saw it happening in a sort of offhand way as he watched the annual death of trees and plants until they seemed to die. And then in the spring of the next year, they would come back to life again. He saw, therefore, the continuous victory of an invisible thing called life over visible things which apparently could live and die. Out of this realization, man came to the conclusion that life was superior to the body that it inhabited. This was logical, reasonable. Philosophy sustained it on through time, even till now. Inasmuch as that which moves other things must be superior to that which it moves. Superior in the sense that it possesses greater life. Thus, as man, through living, proves that he is a servant of this invisible thing within himself, and gradually his body becomes merely the instrument of his purpose, which is not his body, he resolves that his purpose is greater than his body, that his purpose is more real than his body, that it is more alive. And because his purpose can move his body, causing him to select a variety of activities, often even detrimental to the body, or that in heroism or in martyrdom he may voluntarily sacrifice his body for something he cannot see, and that is a principle or a conviction within his own nature. From this and countless other evidences which he came to understand, man concluded that this thing in him, this being, was the better part of himself.